This is the Medicast Live, recorded on October 14th, 2008, released on October 20th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I am here with another episode of the Medicast Live. And the Medicast Live is your opportunity to have a live radio call-in show to talk about EMS issues. And this month, like we do every month, we pick a single topic to kind of kick things off, and then we'll see where it takes us. And tonight we're talking about special event EMS. Now, we're not talking about mass casualty incidents, but those special major events in your communities where people gather in large numbers. And in these situations, we need to be prepared to deal with certain issues involving having large groups of people in one place. And depending on the time of year, you may be dealing with weather-related events, and we'll be talking a little bit about those issues as we move along here. I've got a great group of guests on the show tonight, and I'm looking forward to getting some input from our chat room and also from callers, so feel free to call in. As I said earlier before we started recording, you can call in live. Just dial 724-444-7444. And then when you get prompted, you'll enter the call ID 18174, and you'll be prompted, if you've already registered at TalkShoe, to enter a PIN number. If you don't enter that PIN number, you can go ahead and just come in as a guest, and that's fine as well. Once you're on board, you can click to raise your hand. If you're in the chat room and you're called in, you can actually click to raise your hand in the chat room as well. But if you're calling in and you aren't a registered user, you'll just need to raise your hand by hitting *8, and that'll give me a signal here on my panel to go ahead and bring you in on the discussion. So we're talking about lots of special events tonight, and some of the special considerations that we have, whether it's a huge event like having a NASCAR event where you have 100,000 people coming into your community, or we're talking all the way down to your local county fair and the event that brings people from your local area together in one place. Might even be a local football game. These are all places where people gather, and there are opportunities there for injuries to occur and for the need for medical attention. So this is something that we're going to be discussing tonight, and I've got some very special guests along with us this evening. First of all, I'd like to welcome back Craig Corey. Dr. Craig Corey is an ER physician and also the inventor of the Oxyphone, and Craig's been kind enough to join us again. He has a major racing event that occurs in his community on a regular basis, and he is part of the team that helps prepare for that. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jamie. Appreciate you having me back.
Well, it's good to have you here. And Craig was kind enough to put us in touch with one of the paramedics in his community that is one of the leaders that is involved with getting this all set up and putting these events together, planning the EMS and medical response for those events. It's Alan Thompson, isn't that correct?
That's correct.
So, Alan, we're happy to have you here, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule. We all know how busy everybody is, but it was great to have you here, and we're really hoping to pick your brain a little bit and find out about some of your experience so that when the time comes for us to plan for an event, we'll be a little bit better prepared.
Great.
Great. We also have joining us Jim Huffman from EMS Safety, the EMS Solutions website at ems-safety.com, and I'm going to bring him up right now. Jim, it's great to have you on the show.
How are you doing, Jamie? Glad to be here tonight.
Oh, it's good to have you, and I appreciate you coming in and joining us as well. And hopefully we will be having Rick Rosati join us in a little later. I know he had something else going on tonight, but he was going to be jumping on and joining us. We have a lot of other guests and regular attendees here on the show that we'll be bringing on board periodically. And so, again, anybody on the call-in lines, on the phone lines that wants to add to a topic or ask a question as the time comes up, please hit *8 to raise your hand. Or if you're logged in the chat room, you can click the button at the top of your window there that should allow you to raise your hand in my queue here as well. So I'm going to kick things off, and Alan, I'm going to lead off with a little bit about your experience and talk a little bit about the major event that you deal with in your community and what kind of impact and planning are involved with getting ready for that event.
Okay. Well, we have three major NASCAR races that come to Cabarrus County every year, and we've just recently added an NHRA drag race, and we're probably going to be with a second date on that in the not-too-distant future. The impact is that for our May race, the All-Star race and the 600, we have about 220,000 for each one of those races that come into our community. And that's over a two-week period, but an event we can pretty much expect to have 220,000 when you consider 160,000 to 180,000 spectators for the event, and then you add in the workers, the competitors. And then the fall race typically brings in between 120,000 to 130,000 people to our community. And then the impact that the NHRA race had was about 40,000 to 45,000 into the community. So we have a lot of planning that has to go in place to prepare for those, because our county population is about 160,000. So we significantly increase that county population each time these races come to town, and that's happening four times a year for us right now. So that planning is an ongoing process throughout the year.
So that planning is, you said, is an ongoing process, and Craig, you're part of that process as well. Obviously, we have providers on scene. Do you also arrange for physicians to be on scene as well, or do you remain at the emergency department and allow the EMTs and paramedics on the front lines handle everything?
Well, they usually do what they do best, and it's better for probably doctors to boil water and tear sheets, but I do like to come out to the race and hang out with them, and they let me play with them. I get to ride around, see all the craziness, and watch the wild people. But, you know, it's good sometimes to have people on scene, especially when weird situations arise. Or we do get a lot of refusals out there where people should go to the hospital and adamantly refuse. And sometimes I can help intervene and either help get them in or at least take some load off the paramedics from a legal standpoint. And plus, when we always have plenty of people at the hospital, we put additional personnel on, and everybody's kind of on standby when we have these little zoos.
Yeah, it can be a bit of a zoo. Go ahead.
If I can add to that, what Dr. Corey said is absolutely right. From the standpoint of that planning, one of the important things to remember is that you still have a community or a service area that you've got to take care of. For our normal population, we've got to make sure those needs are met. So we do bring in mutual aid agencies to assist, because basically you have a whole other county set up at the racetrack. So we have volunteer rescue agencies come from around the state, in addition to other EMS services. Physicians from another hospital, part of Dr. Corey's hospital, actually staff an on-site care center. And one of our focus, we've got a couple main focus. One is to provide emergency medical care, provide rapid emergency medical care to obviously have the best outcomes. But those people pay to come to a race. So if we can treat them on-site without having to take them away from the race and they don't have to miss Earnhardt winning the race, then we've done our job. If it's not serious enough to go to the hospital, if we can treat on site, and that could be a rehydration for a dehydration patient. It could be minor wound care. And a lot of that stuff is handled by the paramedics, and what the paramedics are not able to handle, that may go to the local care centers. And for a NASCAR race, we normally have four care centers set up that normally have nurses, paramedics, and a few physicians.
Well, and that's an important point. I've put an article link up in the chat room. This is an article I found over at the American College of Emergency Physicians site at acep.org. And this article is just a kind of a position paper and an article on the effectiveness of physicians on scene and how they assist emergency medical personnel. I know at Ravens games where we have regularly 75,000 or so people in the stadium, that they actually have a physician and a nurse in a small room, you know, hospital type room on premises. I found out about that when I took my son to a football game a little too soon after his appendectomy, and he got a bit pale sitting there in the hot weather, and had to go and get a little rehydration while we while he sat in a bed and watched the part of the game on the TV. But it was definitely important to have those kind of resources there.
I'd have to emphasize again, Jamie, that it's the people are paying to be at the game and they want to be there. And for, I don't know if you've been to the NASCAR race, but for a lot of folks, this is their vacation. They save all year for this, and it's a long way to go for a lot of folks, and they spend a lot on gas and food. And Alan's point is we really try to keep them there as best we can. But then sometimes we get people coming in that are there and they need dialysis. Where are you from? Ohio. Do you know what you get dialyzed with? No. Okay. Well, so we take them to the hospital, and by golly, if we don't figure it out, and our goal is to get them better and get them back. And, you know, we get a lot of overheat and a lot of alcohol out there. But again, the majority of the time it's just kind of treat, get them back in. We keep an eye on them. But the big thing is to have rapid response for those occasional cardiac arrests. And we do have some great saves out there, even from the last race, where just that couple of minutes made a difference. And when you're dealing with that size crowd and the logistics of a mile and a half train track and people spread out everywhere, like, you have to have multiple people responding on multiple levels and a very coordinated attack. And how this anagram we can just work both from the communication and logistics, and then working with extra personnel to get in there and making sure those personnel meet criteria to be providing emergency care in our county. And that's a very complex issue, and it is spread out all over. It's an incredibly large event. I don't know what the square acreage or square miles are there, but it's not just in the track. It's the trailers. It's all the outlying areas, right, and the parking lots that people crash. It just gets nuts sometimes.
Yeah, I've been down to Dover, Delaware, for a race and a couple of times, and I'm just amazed at how that place, you know, you drive past it going to the beach and it's empty. There's nothing there. But when a race is going on, oh my goodness, there's people packed to the gills everywhere. And I can just imagine how that that comes along. Medicast producer is actually my son, Chris. He's welcoming people into the chat room. So, you know, if he asks you a question or something, that's who that is helping me out here tonight. So we're talking about all these people coming in and all these problems, and you're trying to treat them on scene and get them back to a position where they can watch the race. What are some of the more common things you're seeing? Obviously minor injuries, but does it run the normal gamut of a population that size as far as injuries and medical presentation?
I don't believe that it does. Generally, the crowd that we're seeing is young to middle age with some older population. I think Dr. Corey hit on it well with the falls, the alcohol-related. And we see a lot of those type of incidents with the occasional cardiac arrest, the occasional bradycardia, the occasional other type of trauma. But you see a lot of alcohol-related incidents and heat-related incidents. You've got to plan for each event based on two things, the audience and the weather. Who's going to be coming to your event? I would plan differently for a NASCAR race of 220,000 than I would for a concert of 200,000. And based on the band that was coming, because of really their behavior, what they're going to expect, and how they're going to take care of themselves. Two clear examples I can give you. We just had the NHRA race with about 60,000 at this inaugural event. We didn't see near the alcohol, didn't see near the call volume with that as what we would see at a May NASCAR race. So our planning is a little bit different with that. And then we also have two distinct races. We have our May races, which are always extremely hot, major issues with heat-related emergencies. And then we look at our October race. Heat is not usually an issue, but we have to ramp up and be prepared for the carbon monoxide poisonings. For those that fail to take the warnings and the pamphlets that we hand out that say don't bring your generator, don't bring your cook stove inside your tent or your camper, there's always a few that continue to do that, so we're faced with carbon monoxide poisoning in the fall. So we have to look at the audience, the weather, and just those, I guess, those extremes of conditions that will affect the calls.
So you're looking at, you know, obviously environmental conditions, and that's a good thing. What about protecting your providers from those environmental conditions? Because obviously you're going to be, you know, these are people that are usually sitting in a vehicle or in a station, and now they're out in the same weather that they're potential patients are hanging out in. Does that present a problem as well?
For us, it does not, for a couple reasons. One, the group that we take out as part of our disaster response team or special operations team, we've been covering this race for so long, we've already got an idea of what's necessary and how to do it. As part of the whole incident command structure, we've got a medical plan in place that we write that addresses the health, well-being, safety of our medics that are on site. So they know what to do and how to do it and how to take care of themselves. We project things like environment, weather, ants, bees, that type of stuff, in addition to the terrorism threat levels. And with that, we're able to put together a pretty good plan. We take care of ourselves. We've got all the hydration we need for our responders. We prepare our own food so that we're not relying on outside sources that may present some type of problem. We know the type of food to prepare so that you're not sitting out on a 98-degree day and eating egg salad. So we make those type of precautions or planning ahead of time so that we're not faced with those problems. We've been covering the event out there since 1992 at Lowe's Motor Speedway with our full team, and it's just progressed as the size of the event progressed, and a lot of changes have taken place. And the most important thing that I can stress throughout is to develop partnerships, because nobody can do it alone. Our planning starts, it'll start this in November for the events that are going to be held in May and October. We'll start that planning as early as November. And with that, we're able to go ahead and identify what went well at the races this year, what we can do different for improvements, process improvement for the next year. And we've got those resources already starting to put into place, and we'll meet multiple times before the race so that each agency with specialties can contribute. Because, again, you can't do it alone. We can't provide 35 ambulances, and that's what we have on site for a big race. But we can provide the paramedics. Carolina's Medical Center Special Events can provide paramedics for the suites. So we're able to, with those partnerships that we've established, go ahead and do that. And then we also bring in those with specialty skills and planning. We've got people from the FBI, people from wildlife resources, from environmental health, from fire departments, police departments, the Speedway, EMS, hospitals, all of those type of people, ATF, the FAA, all those folks are on site for our planning as we put together our master plan for each event.
So are you using a standard NIMS model, a National Incident Management System model, for controlling the situation at the scene? How do you integrate all of these communications with all these agencies for this type of an event?
We do use a standard NIMS model with a center known as a Joint Operations Center, and I know that's not correct terminology for the full NIMS rollout, but that's a long story, but that's what we ended up calling it. During the race, we actually have a representative from each law enforcement agency, EMS, fire, speedway, security, FBI, ATF, North Carolina SBI for the EOD stuff, and a couple others at the hospital that actually sit in a room for Joint Operations Center. And we use something known as LEO, which the FBI has been gracious enough to grant us access to use that to run the event. So we're able at a glance to see what's happening all over the racetrack, even to the point of having cameras at times through DOT, their key player. We use their cameras to monitor what's going on. So in the event that it becomes necessary, that we've got a major incident at the event, then that becomes the command structure. And each element becomes the operational elements, the EMS or fire operations or law enforcement operations. So we're out doing our own thing, reporting back to there. But in the event that an incident happens, then we roll under that Joint Operations Center, and that becomes the unified command. And then each of our others are operational branches. And then we've already got the geographical divisions pre-established so that we know what Alpha Zone is, Bravo Zone, Charlie Zone, so that we've already got that ahead of time.
So pre-planning as well as post-planning, looking back at previous events and making changes as necessary are really a vital part of making the coordination work well as the next events roll around.
And then one of the important part of that is the protocols that Dr. Corey sponsors and puts out. He briefs us, is his protocols that we use, and basically it gives us the ability to do what we need to as paramedics. The way that we're set up with on-site treatment is if patients can go to the care centers on site, normally we have four setup, then that's what we prefer. Now, we respond out to the patients along with BLS. If it's a BLS call and it needs to be transported, they take care of it. If it's a BLS treat and release, they take care of it. But if paramedics are required, then our medics get involved in it. And if it's something that the on-site care centers can handle, then we'll take them there, let them deal with it. But what we end up seeing, especially in the May raise, is they get overwhelmed with just the sheer volume. It's not uncommon to see over 200 patients on a real hot day that are in need of hydration. We've got a Western shelter that we set up, as well as some other tending that we're able to set up and basically have like a forward area treatment to where we'll assess, monitor, start IVs, rehydrate, monitor their recovery, and if they get better and we feel like they can go back, we counsel them on the risk of not going to the hospital and let them go back to the event. So we're supporting what the care centers are doing, and that's because of the protocols that our medical director, Dr. Corey, has put into place with that emphasis on if they don't need to go to the hospital, they don't have to go to the hospital.
Craig, do you have anything different in those protocols for this disaster response team other than what you would normally have for your crews on the street on a normal day?
We use pretty much the same medications, Jamie. The big emphasis is, again, most of the time you can't come on a dehydration or a heat injury out on the street and not take them to the hospital. The systems aren't set up for that. So the protocols are more designed to truly treat them almost the same way we would in the ED, with the exception of not wasting time on getting blood work and such. But it's still kind of their common sense is what plays a big role in this. And the majority of time people can get fluids. And if it's a 20-year-old who's been drinking too much, a liter of Ringers or saline and some Zofran, and he's going to be normal and go back to the race just fine. But, you know, the common sense plays in. If it's a 65-year-old and they're looking sick and they're diabetic, you know, that's not going to happen. They're going to get treated, but they're going to go to the ER and continue the treatment. So they give more leeway, but it's still the majority is common sense with our standard protocols. They're still the same medications, same, you know, practical application. It's just we let a lot more people go back into the race. But the other thing is we still have contact with them, and we actually will do house calls at the race. So if somebody's in a trailer and they're sick, though they don't want to come with us, we'll treat them, and then we'll keep following back up with them. And if things change, we kind of give them like one chance and we need to go to ER. But protocols are otherwise the same. And they do have a significant amount of freedom to exercise the protocols out there without making contact. But that comes after a long time. I've been medical director for 14 years, so if I don't trust them, they don't do it. So this is a crew that I work pretty closely with out there.
Well, that sounds great, and it's interesting. This is your disaster response team, and you're actively responding to these events on a regular basis. It brings me around to a little bit something that's off topic, but if this is your disaster response team, does this mean that you feel you're much better prepared than another community might be for responding to a disaster because of the fact that you get to practice so frequently?
Okay, well, I would say absolutely. Jamie, because you're testing your resources, your ability to transport, how many people you can transport, what your levels of treatment are, but more importantly, how deep are you staffed? How many, like Gallen says, you have to staff the race. You also have to back that up with the rest of the city, because the city doesn't stop just because the race is going on. So it tests your mutual aid system. It tests communications on multiple levels between multiple agencies, which is always a hassle in a disaster setting. And we've been testing out a new system that actually uses barcoding and radio transmissions to identify patients and track them to the hospital that even includes a picture with them. So we are testing our true disaster system every time we're out there. And it really does, you realize how much information you need, how much equipment you need, and how difficult it is to get things to a situation. And it does bring up the reality of disaster. So it is a constant disaster test, which is really good for us. Fortunately, I haven't had to test it too many times other than the bridge collapse, but the system is there and people get used to working that way. And that's going to be the important thing in a true disaster.
Alan, you had a comment?
Yeah, to piggyback on what Dr. Corey said as far as exercising it, this is that chance for us to exercise it. And I try to view it as that we've just taken a proactive approach. We've got the benefit of having this speedway in our community. So we know it's a risk. We know we've got a plan for it, but it gives us the opportunity to work with our partners. We work with them every day, but to sit down and do heavy planning with them, this gives us an opportunity. So the first time I meet Captain Smith is not going to be on a disaster. I've already been working with him and planning with him, so I know what his agency capabilities are, and he knows what mine are. But the other part of it, it also prepares us for when that incident happens. We've had one major incident and one significant incident at Speedway. We had a tire get into the stands with an Indy race some years ago, killed a couple and had 26, 27 injured. And then we had a bridge collapse, and the bridge collapse was a prime example. Now, we learned a lot of things from it, and I won't say that everything that we did on the bridge collapse was that made it go well was 100% intentional, because the way that it happened, it was a worst-case scenario. But we transported 87 patients in 57 minutes, 107 patients total, 87 were transported 57, in 87 were transported in 57 minutes. And on site, we had no fatalities on the site. Now, we did end up having I think one or two die several years later from complications, but the system worked well. Like I say, there were a lot of things that were in place that helped. There were things that we learned from that have helped us to be more proactive in our future planning.
I think that's a lesson to be learned there, and it's a shame that Rick's not with us tonight, because he talks a lot about this on the Mitigation Journal, which is talking primarily his show looks at disaster response. One of the things he talks about is what he calls the rule of outcomes, that you can use things you're doing in your normal EMS travels, whether it's attending football games and dealing with crowds and local smaller events, to be better prepared for mass casualty events, for disaster response. And it sounds like you guys have taken that to an extreme level, because you have these large events to practice. Do you take those lessons and teach those lessons out into other parts of your surrounding communities?
After the bridge collapse, our EMS director did some presentations on it. I'm one of the certified ICS 100 through 401 instructors in the state, so I do have the opportunity to do some incident command training and talk about some of that. But as far as doing it on a regular basis, we really don't. We're available, and we'll do anything we can to work with folks, but if you've got something we like, we're going to take it too and use it, because our eyes are always open to new possibilities. But those opportunities we've really not had.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to get the word out here just to learn some lessons just based on this discussion, because it sounds it's one of those things. Those disasters don't happen very frequently, but yet you face those type of major challenges on a regular basis throughout the year, and clearly it made you better prepared. I'm not sure how you can stage that in other communities, but certainly you could do some sand table work or something like that to try to plan out. So it's something that, you know, hopefully folks will take that from this lesson. Well, I appreciate the fact that we're looking at these large, huge events with hundreds of thousands of people, but what about, how does that scale down? Because obviously you have other events in your community. Some of the other people in the chat room have talked about football, other gatherings of people, like demonstrations, local football, high school games or college games, as well as local parties or events like raves that get out of hand and require a larger than normal response. Does this scale down very well, that you can, you normally have 30-some ambulances at a NASCAR event? Does it scale down to having two or three ambulances at a local high school game?
It actually does. Another event that we have is our county fair. Roughly 70 to 80,000 attendance over a seven-day period. And we'll staff that with one transport ambulance on site and usually six paramedics to handle that crowd. And we serve a dual role of public relations and being the medical provider on the site. Our EMS system is responsible, not the paramedics, but our rescue squad handles the football games, or the high school football games, that type of stuff, with one or two ambulances. And they fall into our system whenever they do that. We've done some concerts that we've covered. And again, we just, the main focus is we ask ourselves, okay, what are we covering? An example was recently we had a concert that was coming to town on the night of the NASCAR race, the All-Star race. And there were folks that said, this is going to be a problem. But then looking at the band, looking at the type of crowd, by calling around, talking to other agencies that had this band, we were able to identify ahead of time, there's probably going to be 1,500 people at it. So it was staffed with a limited amount of personnel and one ambulance while the NASCAR race was going on. So I think you're able to take it and break it down, incorporate some of the same type of training, not necessarily as in depth. I don't think you've got to have FBI and ATF involved with planning for a Marshall Tucker concert. But on the other hand, you know that those relationships have already been established. So if we have a need to make contact with them, we've already established those relationships. Dr. Corey, did you have something on that? I didn't mean to step in.
That's okay.
No, that about sums it up. It can always be stepped up. And if you look at any day, there's, you know, one ambulance and two paramedics is the starting point for this. And you just have to, you move out from that. You may have more personnel because you have a gator or, like, we have four-wheeler teams to try and get around the parking lots at NASCAR. And you can use a lot of that same equipment at the county fair to get around. And it's still the same communication system. So you get used to the what trunking lines you're going to use and who's going to be the communications focus and the supply focus. And use your same things as an ICS. You have supply, you have logistics, you have command. And you get so used to using those structures, whether you're using one ambulance or using 30, that's what works out. And I think that's the beauty of using it in a big system and being able to scale backwards from that. And you learn lessons on each side of that equation. But the concerts are fine. I think somebody in the chat room mentioned it. It is different people. There's a mosh pit. You got to deal with noise and the fact you can't hear your radios. But again, you work out your logistics ahead of time, and generally those kind of things, it you see what needs to be changed each time you do something, and it works very well for us that way.
So you have these smaller events, and you talked about not being able to hear your radios. Clearly, you all are you know, your disaster response team is an exceptional organization and a group of people that have worked together regularly and are probably better prepared than most. But what about concerns for general safety, especially when you're putting other crews that maybe aren't part of that disaster response team on a concert where you have a couple of ambulances and a few extra paramedics on scene, and they can't talk to each other in a situation where the crowd is drinking alcohol, possibly using drugs, and become unruly for whatever reason? Is there any special preparedness that you guys take when dealing with issues of scene safety in that type of a situation where you're staged at the scene?
Put them with somebody that has some experience in working the event. We try not to, and I'll go to the point of saying that we never place anybody that has never been at an event like that along with another non-experienced person. You're always with somebody who's been there for some time, who has the experience in working out, whether it be a race, whether it be a concert, they've got that experience already there.
It's definitely not a place to learn. It's once your skills are deaf, that's okay, but the street smarts are what makes you safe in those situations. Know when to back down, know when you can be right. But also beforehand, even at the small events, there's still a lot of communication with the police department and the sheriff department, the special ops folks, as well as the firefighters. So you have layers that are protected. You don't respond to any situation by yourself. It's just like on the street. You get a shooting, you don't go in there by yourself and be a hero. You establish where your sticking point's going to be, who's going in, who's in control. You don't have people racing in just because they got a bigger piece of equipment. You don't go places till it's safe. And that's incredibly important in those situations, because any of the concerts, alcohol and drugs are a given. And certain populations just become downright violent when they think you're treading on their toes. So it's important to go in those situations in force. It's hard to finesse those kind of things. So, again, planning ahead and knowing who you're working with and knowing who you trust. And that's a big issue in field medicine, is knowing who you trust. And is your partner going to back you up, or are you going to turn, there's going to be a blank space there? But that only happens once.
Yeah. So you're really saying that it's better to not, it's not a good idea to lowball the crew numbers that are needed in this type of situation, that you probably are better off putting an extra crew in a situation, more than having more people there, just to have a better presence.
Definitely, because again, trying to get people in and out of that situation is also complicated, and you need extra help and extra hands, and who's going to carry equipment. Normally, when you're on the scene and you have four firefighters, two paramedics, and some cops helping you out, everything's great. It's pretty hard to drag all your equipment into a mosh pit, get a guy on a backboard, and get him out of there without having the right number of hands.
Yep. Hey, Kelly had a comment, wanted to raise her hand and join us, so I'm going to bring her up here on the phone lines And Kelly, you wanted to add something to this discussion about concerts and crew members at a situation?
Well, not specific situations, but about event planning. Any event private supplier could almost calculate by percentages based on what kind of concert it is, what kind of supplies and contingencies are needed. I would say only maybe one concert of 100 that are in a given year in a large metropolitan area like Los Angeles has an extraordinary event that causes more casualties than we thought, in the sense that maybe if someone fires off a gun and then there's massive trampling going on. That happened one year. Or something special happens, like I heard about the bridge collapse or the car going into the crowd. So you have to plan for those. But if you go to your local event supplier, private agency, they can statistically tell you how many injuries you're going to have of every kind. Like I was saying in the chat room, you'd be surprised on how many head injuries happen at regular outdoor concerts, which you wouldn't expect. But you have to bring a lot of backboards because people pass each other by hands through the crowd, and eventually they hit an empty spot, and the person goes head first straight onto the ground and sustains may go unconscious or sustain some sort of neck injury where they need to be put on the backboard. And if you're not thinking of that because, hey, it's a concert, why would I need backboards? You're going to run out really quickly. So the advice there is to maybe look statistically at specific concerts on what you might need.
That's a good point. I think there's a lot of resources out there if you are brought in cold to plan for an event where you haven't normally been having to plan for a large event. You should be looking around at resources in your community and talk to other agencies that are already dealing with large events and find out what their experience has been and who they use as a resource. I think that's an excellent point. We had a question from one of our folks joining us from Australia, and he's from New South Wales, and he's asking questions about injuries from broken glass or bottles. Now, I know in my experience recently in stadium events, most of the bottles, the glass bottles are gone. Everything is plastic. Has that been your experience, Alan, as well, or Craig?
We could say that we would love for it to be that way. And despite what they put into place, you're still going to have some glass bottles, especially if they're allowed to bring coolers in at the races. And then you've got what happens in the campgrounds, what happens in the infield. So we still see some injuries. It's not as much as we see on the other spectrum, though, as far as just general falls, falling off campers, unconscious because of a little bit too much alcohol. That's what we see most of. But Dr. Corey can add to that with what he sees in the emergency department.
We don't see that much in the way of people smacking each other in the heads with bottles. Occasionally there's an errant one that's thrown because somebody got angry and tossed it. But most of the time it's aluminum out there or plastic. So it's not like your typical ballroom ball. So that's a little different. I don't know how most of the concerts are that way too. They don't allow much glass in anymore at all. So it's mainly blunt trauma, falls, and either whether you're being dropped on your head at a mosh pit or you're getting tipsy and falling off a 10-foot camper. The end result is still potentially the same. And we've had, unfortunately, several cases of true spinal cord paralysis from camper divers. And you always have to be ready for those. And you have to have, like the lady from L.A. mentioned, you have to have plenty of equipment ready. So if you start, dumping your stuff out to the local ER, you're still going to have lots of stuff there around. So we have a major trailer now that we've been able to get funding for that has about 100 backboards, and we have a couple cases of IV fluids on about 200 liters of fluids. We have lots of bandage supplies and things to do basic care as well. So that the nice thing about that is it's mobile. So you can have it anywhere you need to be in the county, and you can have it close, and you've got ready access to more equipment. So it is important to plan ahead, and you always have to look at your worst-case scenario because, unfortunately, when you look at statistics, it's having only, not many people have 1.2 kids. So it really is, you have to look at what the worst situation is going to be. Plan accordingly, because you can't afford to go, to the wall in every situation. But you have to look ahead and look at your experience and ask other people around how they've been dealing with this as well.
I had to chuckle a little bit when you said camper divers. I think we all have our special terms for the unique patients that we deal with on a regular basis. But I like that one.
It should be an Olympic event, because once you see some of these people, you wonder. I mean, it just like to have been the fly on the wall and watch what happened. But we've heard many, many stories about this, and the majority of them, fortunately, turn out pretty well. But there are some really sad cases with that. But
well, you know, sometimes we have to chuckle a little bit to get through the day, and it's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, we live.
You know, we're not the ones that dove off the camper; they did it.
No.
Just have to clean up the mess. So.
That's right. When you see a 300-pound person wedged between two campers, you know you've been someplace.
Yeah, Kelly's asking, what's a camper diver? I think these are the people that are watching the race or enjoying the race from the top of a camper and for whatever reason end up head first off the camper, if that answers your question there, Kelly, in the chat room. She goes, oh. So, yeah, Kelly actually has a lot of experience. She's also a ski patrol member and deals with those kind of events. Although people are more spread out in those situations, they still have groups of people coming into the community and increasing the population and adding to the challenges. So I'm sure she has a few names for some select injuries too. So we've talked a little bit about provider safety and dealing with providing for first aid treatment on the scene rather than always transporting the patients and getting them not having to take them to the hospital for every little minor injury, that we try to provide an opportunity for them to remain at the event. And that's been my experience. We have, you know, county fair and things like that where we're treating bumps and bruises. We have a lot of equestrian events in our region and on a regular basis. And so we deal with some minor sprains and things. Anything that might be a head injury obviously gets taken out, but we do deal with some minor injuries that people want to stay and watch the rest of the event. And this is something they've been waiting. Like you said, this is their vacation. They're people that have traveled in for some of these major steeplechase events that this is their main trip for the year and they don't want to miss it. And, you know, they have a family member that's performing later on. So it's an important thing to consider.
We try to view it as a PR event also, because these folks represent a huge part of our economy.
Yep.
With those events they come to each year, that makes a major impact on our economy. So we want their experience in Cabarrus County to be a nice one.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think that especially we're a rural area as well, and we have to make sure that people are being prepared for representing the community well. And it's something we talk about when we plan for these events and we take standby crews to these events. And in our region, it's a group of volunteer fire departments that have ambulance crews that are getting together to pull out and stand by for these events. You know, we have uniform standards that are required at these events. We have we talk about the fact that we're representing the community and that these events are important part of the bringing people into the community. And these are relatively small events, but you're absolutely right. It is a PR opportunity, and we've largely had a good response from people. They appreciate the time we're taking and the work that we're doing. So we're getting ready to wind down here. We're about the 45-minute mark. There's a few other things that I kind of wanted to look at. I'm going to provide some links in the show notes for this episode. And for those of you that aren't listening live, this episode will be going up in this week's Medicast on Sunday evening. And I'll be providing some additional links to some municipal and government sites I found around the just doing some web searching for gathering event EMS. And looking at some of the standards and some of the protocols that are in place in other communities. And I think these are good starting points if this is something you're looking at or trying to prepare for in your community to look at. So those links will be provided in the show notes. But we talked a little bit earlier about debriefing and preparing people for the events and upcoming events. How much do the individual providers, Alan, how much do the individual providers in your team figure into the debriefing after an event? Is this something that only the supervisors get together on, or do we really bring everybody in as a team and talk about situations?
We do it two ways. We do it ongoing, for one thing. And I'll keep a notebook, and then my special operations team leader will basically keep a notebook as things come up during the event. That whether it be a suggestion, a piece of equipment, a way to deploy, any type of process improvement as it comes up during the event, we'll go ahead and make a note of it. so that we can get together and talk about it and determine how to implement it later. But as the event is over with, we'll send out basically an invitation to anybody that was involved and say, okay, what did you see that went well? What did you see that could be improved upon? Basically give us any ideas that you've got. And I'll do that electronically. Now, they always have the option to come into my office and talk to me, but I'll do that electronically, and only I'll get a few points. And then my special operations team leader, Dr. Corey, the EMS director, and me as the assistant director, we'll talk about them depending upon where that area of responsibility lies, and then we'll communicate that back in the planning meetings as we start, as we debrief from one incident and we start planning for the next incident. So they do have an input. Down to what food worked best. You want steaks or pork chop?
That works for me.
The other thing, even when we're at the scene, Jamie, it's a constant give and take, because if we need to adapt something for protocol, say we're running out of Zofran and now we have to go back to Phenergan. Well, you know, our system says you can't use Phenergan IV. Well, we can adapt that and do Phenergan and IV fluids, but that's going to take me setting that up and doing it. But we adapt as we go along, and then the next time we're up for an event, we write that into our protocols. This is what's going to work if A doesn't work. If A doesn't work and B doesn't work, then we go to C. And everybody's free to communicate, so it's not a feudal system. Everybody talks, and it gives me a chance to hear what people are thinking about other stuff, not even just there, about other protocols and other experiences. So, plus, we talk to everybody else around us, and again, that same thing. Input sharing makes a big impact on how you work your system, and I think ours is pretty open.
It sounds like it, and it also sounds like you're definitely benefiting from that, because all of that experience comes back year after year, and I think when people feel valued and feel that their opinion is valued, that you end up having a pretty good retention, it sounds like, when you talk about the fact that you have the same crews coming back on a regular basis.
Well, that, like Alan says, good food.
Good food. Hey, you know what? Food is so important. you can get guys to do a lot of things extra if you feed them well. I've always found that to be the case. So that's definitely true. Well, I do have to throw this out there. Kelly in the chat room brought out one of her skiing terms. So for you guys in North Carolina, you can keep this one in the back pocket and use it sometime. When a skier hits so hard, when they crash so hard that all the stuff in their pockets and on them gets spread all over the slope, they call it a yard sale. So
Charlie Brown on skis, huh?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, well.
I remember that.
Oh, well. Yeah. I remember that from some of the mountain bike races.
There you go. That'll work pretty well, I have a feeling. Kenny looks like he raised his hand. Kenny coming in from Colorado, so let me bring him up and see what he has to add.
Hey, Jamie, I just had a fast question for this panel. The thing I see, and especially hearing about a NASCAR race in the South where you would have, I think, alcohol flowing pretty prominently, that you would start to see an overload of the system on treating the amount of alcohol that they would probably see. I'm just guessing that beer is a pretty common commodity at that kind of event. And we see here in Colorado that we get one rave party that's sponsored by a big concert venue that our ER has gone divert for psych divert, trying to hide from the wallet biopsy of having a bunch of drunk kids taking over the ER and shutting them down for the night, as opposed to paying customers coming in through the door. What does NASCAR events like that do about disposition for alcohol? It's just one of the tougher areas for us in this area.
I'll go ahead and bring up Craig and Alan for that. You guys have anything to add to that? I guess this would be Craig's venue.
Well, the bottom line is you still have to assess the patient. And just because you're drunk doesn't mean you need to go to the ER. I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I went to college and I lived through that. So I suspect that there is a certain level of alcohol your body can tolerate. I'm not going to guess on the amount. But again, you have to look at the patient. If they're a young, healthy person, they're not throwing up, protecting their airway, they probably don't need to go into the ER and clutter it up. But if, at the end of the night, if there's no space for them, that's where they go. You know, if we're set up at the race, we got a tent, we're watching them, we're doing the same thing we do in the ER, monitoring those patients. We have pulse ox, we have glucometers, and it's set up, you know, pretty standard way. So if they're okay, they go back home. If they're not, they go to the ER, and then it does turn into my problem. And just like he says, they clutter up the ER until they sober up.
And we also do try to spread some of the transports out. We're fortunate enough to have several hospitals in the area, one in our Cabarrus County, but there are some other hospitals in Mecklenburg County, and we will spread them out a little bit.
It's like his alcohol. Juvenile has a lot of alcohol, and that's the ones that you can't really release. You have to get parents to take responsibility, and we can't see large events releasing a lot of people. But then you have the dilemma is they really don't need transport to an ER, but they're not able to go to a detox center big enough. You all equipped, it sounds like, for a detox situation. We can't.
Well, the other thing we always do, too, is that when we're covering the concert, and it's more of an issue then for the age group you're talking about, most of the kids at NASCAR are drinking age, but at a concert, we'll sit there in the cops, we'll bring the parents to us. They will find out who the parents are, and if they're not there or they're not showing up, they will go get them and find somebody else. Then, again, in that situation, if there's no other alternatives, they go to the ER and they chill out, and we monitor them just like what you're talking about. But another big problem with the race, and this is kind of sort of on that but off the subject, Jamie, is that the people get there, and we pick them up and haul them to the hospital for a cut finger. It ain't our problem to get them back from the hospital to the racetrack. And then all of a sudden, people are separated from car keys and families and how the heck they're going to get home. And that's part of the big issue with their customers, and you try to make this so you don't take them unless you have to. And if you do, you really try to make contact with family. You try to get people to have transport systems to get people back to the racetrack so they can get home. So it's not just a one-way street out there. There has to be communications at all levels with the chaplains and the police and taxi drivers and everybody else who's part of your system to make things work.
I think one other point is some things we do at major events are usually not the common norm. We're not going to do a report for every town hall we hand out, and we're not going to go through a complete assessment for someone that just comes in for a Band-Aid. And I think a lot of it is questionable as to what paramedics are allowed to do and EMTs are allowed to do in special events versus what they're allowed to do in normal standard of care. Has your system seen a lot of liability from having such big events and having paramedics doing extended care versus having a nursing staff that would take care of it that would be more certified for that kind of clinical work?
We've not been challenged on it, and we've actually taken it to a step to where we have some special event protocols in place that allows for the distribution of Tylenol and Motrin and Peptum, that type of stuff, in regards to just basic treatment, with just basic guidelines. You're not allergic to it. You meet this criteria. Here you go.
So you're really not seeing any type of liability for patients that you should have transported that, you know, turns up in severe shape from alcohol or severe shape from heat exhaustion that you've hydrated and released. That's areas that we see out here.
Since we've been involved in it, or at least I've been involved in it, I am not aware of any challenges that have been challenges or claims made against us for a decision we were made based on that.
Great. Thanks so much.
I think the answer to his question, Jamie, too, is that you really count on your, if they look sick, you don't give them the option. And that's always there. We can usually talk people into going to the hospital if they need to go. And then that's the other kind of nice thing with me being on scene is that puts some of my medical expertise there as both to communicate with the patient, but also to communicate with the paramedics. So that's where it's nice to have a decent medical liaison to make those decisions. But, you know, you got to use your judgment in every situation, and whether you're treating a drunk in a tent for an hour, it's no worse than, you know, having that same guy in the back of your ambulance for an hour if you're driving from one corner of your county to the next. So it's still common sense, continuity of care, use your judgment, follow your protocols. I think that's probably what keeps you out of trouble. And at the end of the day, you're supposed to do the right thing for the patient, and generally that works out.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that kind of came to mind when Kenny was talking about this situation is that if you have a hospital that is trying to shut the doors and go on divert to avoid those things, it's an opportunity to communicate with them for the next event and bring them into the planning. Maybe because they aren't included in the planning process, you can make this a more effective community approach to an event. And that may be more effective on future events. That seemed to occur to me because it sounds to me like bringing the community together and the different agencies and the hospitals and the police agencies and the other agencies in the region communication seems to be key to what's giving you all the ability to respond effectively to the different things that you face, along with the fact that you have specialized protocols just for events. And that can be something that can be done when talking with a medical director, with a specially trained crew like you have, that these are special event protocols that we're going to put in place on a given situation for given events. And I think that's my take on it. Would you agree, Craig?
Yeah. And if you got buy-in from your facilities, so we have buy-in from every hospital there. I mean, they staff their ERs differently. Everybody knows how we have to work this and everybody communicates. So it does start at the hospital level and has to go to the EMS level and has to go to the fire level. So you communicate, you plan ahead, you adapt as necessary. And for Kenny's situation, it might even be you can say, hey, yeah, you're going to close the hospital because you don't want these kids. Well, then give us a doc. Have them come to the scene, make the decision with us. If they don't need to be transported, they don't. Or we can distribute them out differently. But for them to close their doors, you know, I was a paramedic in Denver for 8 years. I'll bet you I know which hospital he's talking about, and I won't mention it on air. But, you know, those kind of places still do exist. And while Intalit is a reality, if your doors are closed, you're not supposed to get patients. But that's the wrong thing to do in that situation because it's not fair to the paramedics or the patients.
It's a small world, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's been a great discussion tonight. I'm going to give Craig and Alan, Kenny wants to join us back in again. I'm interested to hear what he has to say. Go ahead, Kenny.
I was just going to reiterate, what a small world, and it's amazing what stories come out of the same environment in EMS.
Over and over.
Absolutely. And in fact, it was interesting to hear joining us from New South Wales. I finally figured out who it was that we were talking to in the chat room, but he have some similar experiences in Australia. EMS is EMS wherever you are. You're dealing with similar situations because people seem to do the same things wherever they are.
By the way, it was a great article about the Australia system, and I think it was EMS magazine this month on their system of education and pay. That was pretty impressive.
It definitely was, and there are quite a few listeners of the show down there, and really I'm glad to have them joining in and get their input. We're going to kind of close out here, and I think maybe, Alan, you and Craig, I'll give you an opportunity to kind of join in with one last recommendation to the listeners out there that are maybe going to have a first-time opportunity to attend an event, whether it's large or small. What suggestion would you leave them with to prepare and what they should be looking for when they get there?
And Bob, your partners in planning, identify who they are up front, get them involved, because instead of working again, everybody has a job that's got to be done, and if we can figure out how to help each other do the job rather than just existing in a vacuum, and things are much more productive. We found that with agencies over the years. We used to have an issue with Highway Patrol or State Highway Patrol, and then when we involved them in the planning and we worked together to make sure each other's jobs were done, things were so much better. So planning, have the right people involved in the planning, but be flexible because every event changes and you've got to be ready to roll with what's dealt you, because we don't have a choice when the stuff happens. You've got to be able to deal with it, and you got to do what it takes to get the job done.
Craig?
I agree. It has to be a community effort, and community is everybody. You don't function in a void. One hospital can't deal with all the problems that pop up. One EMS agency can't deal with it, no matter how big they are. So you really do have to integrate, cooperate, communicate, and the planning in kind of like war and peace. You got to plan in peacetime what you're going to do in war. And if you're doing it where it's comfortable and you get to know each other, you're going to be much better off when the doo-doo hits the fan if you know everybody in that room with you and you know what your resources are. So, and there's not a void out there. There's lots of information through ASAP and plenty of information out there to use. You're not starting over from this. And there's lots of resources that people can utilize. So don't start from scratch. Talk to other people and find out how to do this.
And I would also extend that if anybody's interested, our protocols are actually public on our website at cabarruscounty.us. If anyone would like to look at that, our special event protocols are there too, just real generic stuff. We've got more detail, but it's just kind of like a template, just basic information, basic awareness.
Great. And Alan, if you do me a favor and shoot me an email with that link in it, and I'll make sure it gets put up on the website in the show notes as well. I appreciate that. It's one thing I found when I was searching around was that there were a lot of county and state protocols or templates for planning for events, even, you know, checklists of information to find out prior to an event, and then debriefing checklists to talk about after the event to plan for the next event. And I found those resources online, and we'll have links to some of those that I discovered. But they're definitely out there. And like Craig said and Alan said, don't reinvent the wheel. Get out, you know, start from somebody else's learning curve, and then you can adapt it to your special event. Alan and Craig, I want to thank both of you. First of all, Alan Thompson. Alan is the assistant director for Cabarrus County EMS. He's a paramedic, tactical medic, and really want to thank you for joining us tonight, Alan. And you're welcome back to the MedicCast Live anytime. And we have a variety of topics and something new every month on the second Tuesday night of the month at 10 p.m. So if you have some free time and would like to join us, you're welcome anytime.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you again, Dr. Craig Corey, for joining us here and sharing your expertise as a physician, as well as a person who's involved actively in planning for protocols and planning for these events. Craig, it's a great joy to have you as part of the MedicCast Live community.
Well, Jamie, thanks again. I appreciate doing this, and it's fun being able to discuss these issues. So thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. And just to give you a little bit of plug, oxyphone.com is where you can find a great device that Craig invented for getting nebulizer access to a toddler or a young child. It's shaped like a phone, something they understand and recognize, and it gives them an opportunity to hold something familiar up near their face and get that nebulizer treatment. So check that out. A device that I discovered this past year, and it was featured in a previous episode of the MedicCast as one of our top products of the year. And luckily enough, we also got a chance to meet Craig and bring Dr. Craig Corey on the show. And hopefully we'll have you back many, many times.
I appreciate that, Tammy. I look forward to it.
Well, that's it for this episode of the MedicCast Live. I want to thank everybody in the chat room. Really had a great set of chats going on, and everybody really bringing a lot to the table in the chat room. So for those of you that are listening to this after the fact, try to catch the next one, because there's a lot of things and questions and answers going on in the chat room that are outside of what's going on in the audio portion of the podcast. And you only get to find those and see those if you're actually live on the show. So you certainly, there was a lot going on. And I want to thank everybody in the chat room. Thank Kelly for her comments on Event EMS, and also Kenny calling in from Colorado. It's great to have you back on the show, and we look forward to having you back as well. We're going to go ahead and close out here. I want to remind everybody that you can find more programming like this over at MedicCast.com. There's a whole series of podcasts at MedicCast.com, weekly MedicCast podcast, the Nursing Show podcast, and the MedicCast News, all available with information for EMS providers and other medical professionals, and you'll find all of that there. Also, like to remind you, next month we will be back with another episode of the MedicCast Live. We're going to be talking about cold weather emergencies and dealing with patients in cold weather, and also protecting ourselves in cold weather situations. That's coming up on the 11th of November. So I hope that everyone will be able to come back and join us on Tuesday night, November 11th. At 10 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about cold weather emergencies, both dealing with the cold weather emergency patient and protecting ourselves from cold weather. So that's it. We're going to wrap up here, and I'll thank everybody for joining us again and reminding everybody out there to remember, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, wanting all of you to keep in mind scene safety and BSI.